Hi. Thank you, everybody. As you can see, I am not Kathleen Baker. I'm Randy Kinman, and I'll be chairing today's Policy Advisory Council meeting. Kathleen is unavailable, so be kind, be nice. And we have a quorum, so we can get going here. Our first item on the agenda is, and I just want to remind everybody that when we get to item 7, we will be going off audio cast as we do breakout sessions. That's why you're seeing all the little chairs sitting around. So we'll be going on to item number 2, approval of the 2014 minutes. I hear a move to approve from Rich. Do I hear a second?
Second.
From Jim. Is there any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstaining? Motion carried. Abstaining. Vita's abstaining.
Will.
And Will.
Will, wait.
And Elizabeth. 3 abstentions.
And Carolyn.
And Caroline. Last call for abstentions. Okay. Subcommittee reports, Naomi.
Okay, thank you. So the Equity Access Committee met earlier, and our main item was an update on the Clipper. And so, believe it or not, Clipper's ready to look at its next generation of service, or as they like to call it, C2. And so we heard an update on some of the expansions that are coming up soon and some of the issues they're looking at. Modes, type of payment. I urge everyone to look at the agenda on the website because there's a link to the PowerPoint that we saw, and that will give you a lot of background information. There's going to be a survey, and so I urge you to participate in that. It's an online survey to provide your input, and we also had specific input related to different languages and access issues for people with disabilities and seniors and low incomes and basically all the different people who may need some help accessing their Clipper. So please check that out. Was there anything I missed after I left? Okay, thank you.
No, I just think that it's incumbent on all of us to make sure that Clipper gets as much information ahead of time as possible so that they can make round 2 a better and more robust system for all of us. I do want to point out that we did have public comments not on the agenda as item number 3. I had no cards, which is why I didn't call that item. Moving on to item number 5, 2015 Public Participation Plan. Ellen, thank you. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ellen Griffin from MTC's Legislation and Public Affairs staff. And I want to thank you for listening to me yet again on the public engagement process for MTC. We had a really great brainstorming session last spring and then came back a month later and summarized some of your ideas. But I did just want to check in and let you know the process. We're about to release a draft public participation plan. For those of you who might have missed those other meetings, MTC is required to do a public participation plan under both state and federal law, and really it's to shed daylight on our admittedly complex process, to give people the opportunity to understand the decision milestones, the technical work milestones, and try to weigh in and shape that process. And as I said, it's required, but I think we'd probably need to do it anyway just due to the demand from the public who really wants to have more of a say in key planning decisions. So our public participation plan does have some overall principles for public engagement, and I won't read those to you, but it's just, we constantly need to remind ourselves to say things in plain English, plain language. And, you know, if you guys ever see bad examples, send them my way. I'd love to, I'm on a quest to try and get our information in as clean a language as possible. But here's what I really wanted to let you know. You may have gotten a notice that we're having a public meeting tonight just to hear ideas from the public on, you know, how to improve our process. So that's happening tonight. We will be releasing a draft public participation plan for a 45-day comment period next month, and we'll present that November 14th to the Legislation Committee. Then there'll be a long public comment process. We'll come back to you once the draft is out, in case, you know, so you can weigh in, make some suggestions. We'd love to get recommendations from you. If there are major changes needed in response to the public comments, we would reissue the draft for a second comment period. And so the final plan would be adopted by MTC either in January or March of 2015. And we do this every 4 years, every planning cycle. And so we're doing this again in advance of the Plan Bay Area update. And I also just wanted to give you some information on that, since this is really the plan for the plan. It is a focused update. We just adopted, it seems like very recently, the last plan in 2013. And so so far there's not anticipated to like start with a blank slate. It's just a focused update with an emphasis on system maintenance. There would be possibly some new initiatives and projects like freight, for example, and integration of some of the work of our regional agency partners like sea level rise or adaptation, for example. And then the PPP will also highlight some of the key milestones in the Plan Bay Area update process. It starts with goals, project evaluation, then the planners do forecasts, develop scenarios, and then we release a draft and a final plan for public comment. So with that, this is just an update. One ask, we do have an online comment forum, and if I develop some text for Pam to email to you all, I'd love it if you could forward that email to your organizations you network with, if you're part of a group with membership, to your members, anybody. We're just trying to get as many comments as possible, and so sometimes us sending it out won't get a response, but if you send it out for us, you know, people might be more willing to do it. It's a simple survey that's online right now at the One Bay Area website. So with that, unless there's any questions, I'll be back in November.
Vita?
Hi there. This is Vita Flores from Marin County. I'm wondering when the PPP final draft will be released to the public.
Well, the draft is going to be released November 7th to start the 45-day comment period. If there is a revised draft, that would be issued in January. If there aren't significant changes needed in response to public comments, then it would just be a final draft that we present to the Ledge Committee and then to the Commission.
And
when do you anticipate actually sending it to Sacramento?
You know, interestingly enough, we are reviewed periodically by the U.S. Department of Transportation, and they look at our public participation plan, but we don't transmit it to the there's no requirement that we transmit it to Sacramento. We're required to adopt one.
Ben?
I have a quick question about the average age of public participants in this plan. Have you seen that change over time? And I mean, are we getting younger people to participate who are, you know, trans?
I think
riders?
That's an area that we definitely need help with. If you look at people who come to our evening meetings, you know, it tends to be an older crowd. We do have partnerships with some community groups, and they have been able to bring in youth and we hear from them that way. My staff has been out at community events recently surveying the public just to understand what they would like in terms of getting updates and so forth about transportation. And you tend to hit a younger demographic that way, too, if you're at a community event. But that is one of the we had an evaluation of the last Plan Bay Area process, and that was one of the recommendations, is to try and get youth more involved in a long-range plan, since it's really it's all about the future, and it'll be their future more so than mine. So,
Jerry?
Yeah, along that same line, have you found that the issues that are being discussed by the participants, have they changed substantially in the last 3 to 6 years?
Well, yes. I think our the last planning process, because it was done in conjunction with ABAG and because of SB 375, a landmark legislation that required us to link transportation with housing and land use, that did draw in a lot more participants, a lot more interest. We heard very frequently from people who were concerned about private property rights. They hadn't engaged in our RTP process in the past. So, yeah, I think it did. We worked with local governments in a way that we had never had before. We tend to, on the transportation side, our partners generally are transit operators or county-level congestion management agencies or public works directors, but this brought in the planning directors from local government, from cities and counties. They became an important constituent. We heard from the public health community to a larger degree, I think, than we had on previous plans. So a whole range of new voices were at the table.
Thank you. Will?
You know, in San Francisco, the free transit for youths and or school-age kids on it, did that bring in a lot of input from other counties? Because it seems like I would believe that other counties are viewing this or considering it. And did the youth from those counties express a viewpoint on it?
During the last plan, I don't recall a lot of I think that was the program you're referring to was proposed rather late in the process. I think it was pretty focused on San Francisco, but it wouldn't surprise me if it's something we hear in the next process as well.
Good enough.
Are there any more questions? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're moving on to everybody's favorite subject, cap and trade funding. It's one of my faves. We have Matt Maloney here. Thank you and welcome.
Good morning. I just have to load up the, do I do that? He does that. I have a presentation for you. Yeah, oh, I could have done that. Okay, I just didn't know. Thank you. Good morning, everybody. So cap and trade, I'm going to do my best to simplify what is a extremely complex subject with a lot of moving parts. I'll do my best to do that for you this morning. My name is Matt Maloney. I'm with the Programming and Allocation section at MTC. I gave a very similar presentation this morning to our Programming and Allocations Committee. And I know a few of you here were here for that presentation. And I'm going to talk about, give kind of a similar presentation, a similar treatment this morning for all of you. So as I said, the state, there's a lot of momentum right now at the state level on various components of this program. There's a variety of different programs, all of which have different administering agencies and different guidelines. And so as staff, we're watching that very closely. I think most centrally what I want to discuss this morning is MTC has an adopted framework that the commission approved back in December for how cap-and-trade monies should be invested. And what we at staff have been focusing on is looking at that adopted framework and comparing it to what has come out at the state level to kind of see where we are and to see whether it's achievable. So that's really going to be the main subject of my presentation this morning. So to remind everybody what the MTC framework is and where it came from, Plan Bay Area in its financial plan for 25 years included $3.1 billion in expected cap and trade revenue. So that's what Plan Bay Area said. Subsequent to the plan being adopted, the commission kind of drew up some investment buckets for that money. So in general, how would we want this $3.1 billion to be spent? And that's shown on the screen for you right now. There's five major funding categories that were adopted by MTC. Transit Core Capacity Challenge Grant Program, which I'm sure many of you know about. It's primarily money to rehabilitate and modernize the core of our transit system in the Bay Area. Similarly, we have a transit operating and efficiency program, which is a $500 million commitment for transit operating in the Bay Area. So that's also part of our framework. Third, an augmentation of the OBAG, or One Bay Area Grants Program, which really kind of blends transportation and land use and housing and makes transportation improvements across the region, with most of the project selection being done by the counties. Climate initiatives was another bucket of funding, as well as goods movement to enable the efficient movement of freight through the region. So this is what MTC has adopted. So meanwhile, the state has acted with its own programs falling out of the state legislation. What we know so far is that in the first year, there is $872 million statewide for cap-and-trade programs. Also, and perhaps more importantly, there is a long-term funding framework after the first year, which doesn't necessarily have dollar amounts attached to it, but does establish program categories and sort of funding percentages. So if we get more money, we know that a certain percent goes to the following categories, and that's up on the screen here. So this is really the statewide revenue framework for the cap-and-trade program. And a couple key points about this, I think the most obvious is that 40% of the cap-and-trade funding is currently uncommitted. So there's no program or set of projects or any administering agency attached to that. It's uncommitted. We're not sure what's going to happen with it yet. 60% of the funding is more committed in terms of which program it's going to flow out to. We have no idea about projects yet, but we do know the program categories. And so those are on this table up on the screen, 25% to high-speed rail, 5% to a program called the Low Carbon Transit Operations Program, 10% to the Transit and Intercity Rail Capital Program, and 20% to the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities Program. And so the state agencies responsible for each of these programs are on the right side of that table. And so you see it's spread pretty widely across different state agencies in terms of who's responsible. The other key point that I want to make is the future funding for cap and trade is very speculative, and it could be very volatile, and nobody really knows exactly what the dollar amounts are going to be. MTC has kind of taken a stab at that, and we assume a statewide amount of $2.5 billion annual for this program after the first year. And this is sort of based upon other legislative proposals and other forecasts that we've seen other entities make. So I think it's important just to mention that, because a lot of the dollar figures that I'll be referring to throughout the remainder of this presentation kind of fall out of this $2.5 billion assumption. So I just want to make that clear. So a question that we've been asking as staff is the cap-and-trade framework that the commission adopted back in December, is it achievable, and is it compatible with the state programs? you know, is it a reasonable fit? And I guess the short answer today is yes, we do think it's achievable. And we think it's reasonably compatible, but of course there are a few caveats to that. And a couple of them I'll mention now is that achieving that strategy is going to require some amount of regional solidarity. You know, essentially we're going to need to pay attention and attend to the priorities that we've set as a region and try to follow through on them and work together in that regard. Secondly, we need to work closely with the state agencies on the guidelines and the program development. We need to pay attention to all of the moving parts that are happening through this program and just make sure that regions and MPOs have a coherent role in how these programs transpire. So this table is kind of it's called Achieving the Region's Cap and Trade Framework. And what's on this table, on the left side, what this table really does is it crosswalks the MTC framework with the state programs that are out there through cap and trade. So on the left side of the table, those two columns, you have the MTC framework category and the MTC framework adopted amount. So these are those left columns are the categories that the commission approved here in the Bay Area. On the right side, we're talking about the cap and trade programs being put out by the state. So essentially, we're trying to align our framework with the state programs. And you know, I think that what you can see here is that there is a reasonable fit, we think. Core capacity matches up well with the eligibility under transit in the intercity rail capital program. For the transit operating program, we think there's an avenue to achieve that via the low carbon transit operations program. The OBAG program fits reasonably well with the affordable housing and sustainable communities program. Where I think it's still a little more uncertain are these last two categories. One, really climate initiatives, which really have to do with sort of technological advancements for transportation, kind of innovative solutions for transportation to reduce GHG, and the goods movement categories. And that's really just because there's currently not a natural fit in the state cap and trade programs for this type of work. But then again, we think that coming down the pike, there will be from this 40% uncommitted category. So I want to run quickly through the MTC adopted framework and just to kind of reiterate what these programs are. The first is the Core Capacity Challenge Grant Program. This is a $7.5 billion regional commitment to fund key transit capital replacement and rehab needs across the region. So that's a lot of money, $7.5 billion, and a portion of that funding is $875 million from cap and trade. So that was our expectation when we put this program into place, is that a percentage of the money would come from cap and trade. There's also pieces of the money that are based from federal funds, regional and local funds, things along that line. So we are counting on cap and trade revenue to deliver these projects. And up on the screen, I am just listing the specific projects that actually have cap and trade funding attached to them. So these are not all the projects in core capacity in the whole program, but these are the ones that have some cap and trade funding. So it adds up to 875, and on the right side of the table, we can kind of show how we can achieve that through this transit capital state program. Similarly, the transit operating and efficiency program is a $500 million program in our framework to support the Plan Bay Area goal of a more robust and expanded public transit network anchored by expanded local service. And on this slide, on the left-hand side, we show you those dollar amounts by operators. Again, this is what the MTC Commission approved. Adds up to $500 million. This commitment is funded entirely through cap and trade revenues. And again, we think that there's an avenue to achieve that through this low-carbon program. So a couple issues with transit that we wanted to point out in terms of the state programs. I think first, and I've said this already, that the cap and trade funding amounts, the future amounts, are pretty speculative. We don't know exactly what they are. Some of the funding amounts in the low carbon program could be very small, might prove challenging for some operators. And I think maybe even more importantly is that our core capacity challenge grant program, the projects in that program are pretty big. They're major expenditures. Replacing all of the BART rail cars, for example, major multi-year types of expenditures. You know, one concern is that the state program may come out sort of in drips. You know, every year there is some annual funding, but there may not be the level of predictability and certainty that we want in order to make some of these bigger multi-year commitments. So we're looking for more predictability from the state in terms of the funding, and that's just maybe a gap between what we're trying to achieve in here in the region and what the state is putting out. The One Bay Area Grant Program, or OBAG, just to quickly review, it was a major initiative that fell out of Plan Bay Area, again, to fund transportation improvements near high-quality transit and higher-density housing. We have a funding distribution based on population and housing factors. Some of the projects that fall out of OBAG are typically bike ped improvements, complete streets, station improvements, streetscapes, local streets rehab, those types of projects. Our hope, again, is that we can augment these types of projects through OBAG, through the Affordable Housing and Sustainable Communities program that the Strategic Growth Council is running out of Cap and Trade. And there are some issues with the alignment between OBAG, the MTC program, and AHSC. Sorry for all the acronyms. There's not much we can do about it. But AHSC, which is the state program. So there are some issues and really some challenges and opportunities. I think one of the challenges is that these guidelines are actually out. I don't know if anybody here has actually looked at the guidelines that the Strategic Growth Council has put out, but they're out right now. They're looking for public comment on them. They were released last week or the week before, and there's comments due in late October, and they're not an easy read. They're very complicated. They're over 80 pages long and fairly rigid in terms of their eligibility requirements. And that could be a concern for the region in terms of how we actually try to put project proposals together to meet all these eligibility requirements. Affordable housing is a big emphasis in this program. That's obviously a huge need up here in the Bay Area. It's important. I think one of the questions we have, though, is can we implement projects quickly? Can we get the money out the door and get projects underway? You know, also, there is no guarantee the OBAG distribution formula can be achieved, and this is really because we're at the mercy of the state in terms of how that funding flows. So that's something that we have to keep in mind as we talk about augmenting an OBAG-type system. So some of the opportunities, however, is that we do think there is a role for regions in AHSC. It's still kind of unclear what that role is going to be. The Strategic Growth Council met earlier this week at their board meeting, and this was kind of one of the items that was under discussion at that meeting was kind of the regional MPO role. What could it be? I don't think they necessarily came to grips with that, but they had a discussion. So MTC, ABAG, local agency staff, there may be some role for us in terms of screening projects, perhaps trying to identify projects, evaluating projects alongside the state. There appears to be some role, but we just don't know what it is yet, and we can't clarify that. So hopefully we get more clarity on that as we move forward. Given the affordable housing piece of this, there is a potential to leverage gap financing and grants for things like TOA, the Bay Area Transit-Oriented Affordable Housing Fund. We think that there's a nice alignment between TOA and this program, potentially. We also wanted to mention, too, there's a separate AgLands component administered by the Natural Resources Agency. The first year is going to be about $4 or $5 million. It may align well with the region's Priority Conservation Areas program, which is another program that comes out of OBAG. So there is some money here on the ag lands part as well to do planning, to look at ag, to prioritize ag land, land uses, and do things along those lines. So one of the big issues out there with cap and trade as a whole is the disadvantaged communities definition. As the weeks go by, we are getting some more clarity on this, but we're still not there yet. And it's been something that staff has been watching very closely. Essentially, the Cal EPA has a method or a model called Cal Enviro Screen, which they are using statewide to determine, quote-unquote, what disadvantaged communities are and where they're located. The concern that MTC and our regional partners have had since the beginning is there's not a lot of overlap with MTC's communities of concern. A couple other metrics here which stand out: of the top 10 most impoverished census tracts in the region, not one of them is included in CalEPA's model. So that's troubling to us. And so what are we doing about that? Well, for one, MTC and regional partners have been proposing specific modifications to the criteria. We've been on record to CalEPA in some letters. There's also some policy conversations that are going on with members of the staff about this. And essentially, you know, we want to see the science behind this model brought a little more up to date. We think that there's some work that they can do in terms of weighting some of their variables differently. One of the other things that we're not seeing CalEPA do is bring really the idea of rent burden into account here. And obviously, this is a very expensive place to live creates a huge burden for a lot of our residents. And we think that that ought to be taken into account at a minimum in some of these calculations. So we're working on it. We wish we had more clarity on where this is headed. But again, it's a big concern, especially since a considerable percentage of the funds from cap and trade are to be spent either within disadvantaged communities or to benefit disadvantaged communities. Not all of the money, but a sizable amount. We agree with that, but we want to just make sure that they get it right in terms of the Bay Area. Another issue is greenhouse gas calculations. What's going to be the methodology across all these different programs for how different projects reduce greenhouse gases? To date, we don't know. We don't know what the state is going to put out there in terms of its methodology for this. We haven't seen guidelines on the methodology. And, you know, one of the other things that we're thinking about as a region is, you know, how do we make that case, especially for on transit capital projects, for projects that really modernize the system, improve service, but aren't necessarily big expansion projects? How do we make the case about the GHG benefits associated with these types of projects? We think we're going to need to do that. We're going to need to articulate that well for the state, and so that is something that we're working on. So just to wrap up here, a couple more slides. One is stakeholder involvement. And I guess what I can say here is we're partnering with anyone and everyone that we can in terms of making comments to state agencies as they roll the guidelines out. We've been very active on the disadvantaged communities definition side and working with transit operators, the CMAs, and others on, you know, these regional cap and trade commitments that we made back in December. Can we achieve them through cap and trade? And again, it kind of goes back to we need regional solidarity and kind of everybody working together and rowing in the same direction. So that's been one of our efforts. So I'll stop there, and I'm happy to take any questions or feedback. We would love to get your feedback today, and this is going to be a continuing conversation that staff will have with many of our committees here at MTC. So thank you.
Starting with questions, Vita.
Hi. I wanted to thank you for your presentation, firstly. It's really comprehensive. And my question is on the methodology on the enviro screening. And I really want to thank you for calling attention to the rent burden as part of an area that we should focus on. And I'm wondering how and where we can find out more information on the Cal Enviro screening so we can educate ourselves.
Sure. And that's something that, at least offline or online, we'd be happy to make that information available to the committee. The CalEPA does have a good amount of information out there about their methodology. I believe there's, you know, a white paper or a few other things that go into detail about that methodology. So it's good to look at that just for background. And I think at the same time, you know, we're on record with a fairly lengthy letter that we actually sent via the Joint Policy Committee. So it includes our other partners, the Air Quality District, ABAG. And that letter also kind of goes through and articulates what the specific concerns are that we have with the methodology, and it also kind of articulates what we would do differently in that methodology. So that's another good piece to look at. And that letter is out there. It's public. And I'd be happy to get both of those to you, maybe via Pam, if that makes the most sense.
Yeah, that would be great. It would be very interesting to look at the letters that you've worked on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank
Thank you. Carlos?
Thank you. I had a question back on the affordable housing sustainable communities program. I'm just trying not to use the acronym. And you were talking about how kind of the issue there between OBAG, so is that, I can't remember the slide 12, I guess, you know, kind of reconciling OBAG with the AHC SCP. Yeah. And I think you made a comment. I kind of wanted to see if you could expand a little bit on the, you seem to have a concern about the ability for the state to get the money out the door quickly. Was it for to spend it on affordable housing? I didn't quite understand the comment there.
I think, sure. I think one of the concerns we have is that when you go through the guidelines they've put out about project eligibility, they're just dense.
Okay.
And, again, it's not an easy read, and there's a lot of different criteria out there. So, you know, in terms of kind of ensuring that your project is actually eligible for this money, there just seems to be a lot of hoops to jump through. Mm-hmm. A lot of just overlapping, dense, numerous criteria. And I think, so one of the concerns that we've just had as staff is, are these criteria too rigid?
Mm-hmm.
Should they allow for a little more flexibility so that project sponsors maybe have an easier time finding projects to fund? Mm-hmm. So I think one thing we have to remember is that this is going to be a considerable amount of money annually. And I think we want to get the best projects we can, but we also want to make sure that the money can be spent and go out the door and not just sort of sit there.
Mm-hmm.
Does that help answer your
question? Yeah, I mean, just a follow-up on that one just is, because I think you also, and I couldn't remember if it was kind of in the same breath, a comment about how maybe they hadn't really thought about kind of the regional role, I think. Was that kind of what you said? I didn't know if that's part of that, kind of that there's all this dense, you know, criteria that doesn't really allow, you were saying flexibility. I mean, I don't know if that's kind of part of the...
I think it is part of it. I think that they have not clarified a regional role, and yeah. Actually when you look at the program guidelines, it acknowledges that at the outset, that mm-hmm. there's going to be some role for MPOs throughout the state in this process, mm-hmm. but they still haven't figured it out.
Okay.
So they acknowledge that publicly, and I think it's just something that when we get past the draft guidelines and get into final guidelines, we are under the impression that that role will be clarified. We think that regions should have a role in these programs that is coherent and that makes sense and helps get better projects. You know, to the extent that we're in touch with our counties and our local governments, and really that they know best in terms of what projects are ready to go and which projects would be sort of transformative and reduce GHG, be good candidates for that. You know, we think that potentially MTC and ABAG and our partners could be a good vehicle for those projects to bubble up. But I think kind of the devil's in the details in terms of how that works out, how the arrangement with the regions vis-a-vis the state is done, and the mechanics of how that works. And I think there's a lot of unknowns with that. I think Alex might.
May I ask a
Carlos,
follow-up?
I just wanted to add one
okay.
thing to your question. Alex Bockelman, Deputy Executive Director for Policy. Just to add one point to what Matt said, I mean, I think while we have some concerns about whether money will get projects moving quickly, I think that said, the Strategic Growth Council obviously has set forth a fairly ambitious schedule that has projects due in April and has awards in June. Mm-hmm. So if they keep that schedule, I mean, potentially the money does get out the door fairly quickly in the first year. Whether or not there will be complications related to any litigation, I mean, nobody knows that. But I think that they are on a fairly, they do have a fairly ambitious schedule, and they want to get the money out the door quickly. So I just wanted to make sure to note that as well.
Thank you. I had a slight follow-up on because, again, it's kind of this alignment. I think in the previous chart, there was a couple of where, again, you were aligning the OBAG, or in general, the MTC framework with the cap and trade. And the one thing that I've heard, I want to see if you can clarify, because I haven't read the guidelines, you know, but has the cap and trade guidelines identified a little bit more about what exactly sustainable communities is? Because I guess affordable housing, that's pretty clear, but what's, because I think under the OBAG, you were giving examples of things that weren't, you know, complete streets and things like they weren't affordable housing. So the question is, in all this dense guidelines, have they started to give some clarity on that? Or
I think so, and without going into too much detail, the way the state guidelines kind of articulate this is through they're looking for projects that are really transit-oriented development-type projects, and they're also looking for projects that are – they came up with a new acronym, ICP, Integrated Corridor Projects, Connectivity Projects, something like that. They're kind of new terms for all of us. I think there's – you know, what they're looking for in those two categories I think is very akin to what we would all think about as being sort of sustainable communities. I mean, places that, you know, encourage travel options for all users – you know, more walkable, bikeable types of communities, places where transit is accessible, where the stations are maybe more modern, and also where you've got adjacent affordable housing nearby. And I think, you know, the affordable housing is a critical piece of this in terms of the Strategic Growth Council program. And, you know, I think when we think about those types of things, we think it's very ambitious, as Alex said, and it's important to get these projects moving. You know, the question is that it's some of these projects could be big and they could be complicated and require a lot of assistance from local communities, affordable housing developers, transit operators. So it's a lot of different actors. And so we just have to think about that as we sort of look at the guidelines moving forward.
Alan?
I'm wondering in the area of the disadvantaged communities and how we know it's weighted towards the valley, and it's a definite redistribution of income and source. Who is making that final decision, and how can we affect that decision? And can that decision be affected through the Senate, through the legislature? Or is this a decision in the hands of staff that we're not going to be able to really make an impact aside from making as much noise as we can?
Right. Well, it is. So there's two primary agencies at the state level that are responsible for this, and one is Cal-EPA and the other is the Air Resources Board. You know, Cal-EPA is obviously an administrative agency of the state, of the governor, and you'd hope that all these agencies are answerable to some extent to the governor and the legislature. But that being said, you know, the Cal-EPA guidance on disadvantaged communities is likely just to come out from the agency itself. It's likely to be released. ARB, the Air Resources Board, is tasked with looking at the benefits to disadvantaged communities. So they're not making the map. They're actually trying to crosswalk, well, okay, we have a transit project. How do we look at how that might benefit the map? So how do we kind of put those two kinds of things together? You know, ARB obviously has a board that their staff answers to. And so to that respect, there is a body which has representatives from across the state. So, you know, I think that, you know, and Alex might want to add on to this. So I think that it's probably a two-pronged or three-pronged effort. Maybe one just working administratively with some of the staff, perhaps with some of the ARB board members. And I think it can't hurt if you have a concern about the disadvantaged communities definition, certainly to reach out to your state representatives.
I think it would be very good to get some guidance on this. And for the advisory board to have guidance on this so that if we decide there should be an impact on it, we can make an impact on this because I think we're all integrated well into our communities, and we know the people, at least at the Senate and the legislature. I'm not very familiar with the Air Resources Board, but they seem to be a group by themselves.
I'll just add on to this. I think that, you know, we can certainly send out something that can get distributed to everyone, but I think, you know, reaching out to the Bay Area delegation is very important. It is something that MTC has done with our regional partners through the Joint Policy Committee. So I think that's very important. I think the most important thing we're focused on right now is Cal-EPA because they're the ones that are drawing the map. CARB has already sort of opined, at least for interim guidance, and they didn't really hear us. So we sort of lost maybe round one with CARB. I don't know if I said CARB. That's what I meant to say. But Cal-EPA any day now is expected to kind of come out with the map. So I think, you know, obviously reaching out to the Bay Area delegation, which we've been doing, and Secretary Rodriguez, and he is the head of Cal EPA. I think our executive director this morning maybe said it correctly. He said that I think EPA is finding themselves in a pickle because I think that the secretary is probably not finding much time to do anything but take calls from various legislators throughout the Bay Area and San Diego and maybe other parts of the state. So I think they're hearing plenty of concern, but they also are very wedded to the Cal EnviroScreen tool that they've developed for other reasons that they would like to apply to this cap and trade program. So it's a matter of whether they can find ways to make some adjustments to the use of EnviroScreen, which I think the Air District has come up with some very elegant ways to do that. Whether or not they'll, hopefully they'll take some of that input. I doubt they'll take all of it. So anyways, I think Secretary Rodriguez and our Bay Area delegation are the folks that we should be focused on. You know, and maybe Rebecca can add, I mean, we really expected to have the map drawn, I think, by October 1, so we're just sort of waiting day to day to hear when Cal EPA is going to release this definition of disadvantaged communities.
Thank you. Rich?
Yes, I was at the meeting on October, I think it was the 3rd. Rebecca was there. And I didn't think it was very well organized. I think the impression I got was they had not expected to hold a meeting, but was for, this is not one of our meetings. This is a state meeting. That they were forced to hold it by some of the legislators from this area, and there was a lot of comment about the program and the way it had been drawn together for the purpose of distributing the money. And generally, in most of the meetings, the little group meetings we had, if somebody brought something up negative, they were told it wasn't proper in that particular group. It had to be registered in another group that you hadn't chosen to go to. And so it was very I'm still trying to rationalize the whole meeting. If others were there and saw more rationality to it than I did, please speak up. I'm seeing Carlos shake his head no. But it seemed like it was more form than function, I guess is what I'm saying, and not much got accomplished and not much got listened to by the state group that was there.
Thank you. Caroline?
I just wanted to second what Alan is saying about the disadvantaged communities piece, and Vita brought it up too. I'm really interested in this as well, and I'm more than willing to go to my legislators and talk to them about it, but I think the more information that we have, and I can do some research obviously too, but any information that you can provide us I think would be really appreciated in terms of preparing to do that. And I'm very, very interested in what the actual definition is going to be, and if we can be a part of that, I think that would be even better.
That sounds great.
Rebecca Long with MTC staff. I did just want to make one comment. You know, I've been working on this quite a bit with Matt and others and very closely with the Air District. And I just want to kind of, again, give the committee a sense of the timing of this, because I do think to some extent the opportunity to kind of express, you know, our recommendations has already occurred. As Alex stated, the Air Board has adopted their interim guidance. We didn't get most of what we asked for there. And now Cal EPA has definitely heard, and part of that is thanks to a lot of the letters that you all wrote. You know, we've talked about this quite a bit in this committee. You know, members of the Policy Advisory Council went to the workshop, and so I think they know, you know, where we are. And our delegation, the Bay Area delegation, has been really great and effective in communicating the message. So I just want to kind of put some context onto it. I think once they issue the maps, you know, then it's sort of another conversation. You know, what do we do next? Do we revisit this? And then, as I think Matt stated, there is going to be a subsequent guidance, a more formal guidance that the ARB is going to do next year. And maybe that's an opportunity to kind of revisit this again. But I think in the short term, you know, I mean, it's great if you want to, I think if you want to do something, contact Secretary Rodriguez. I think the legislature, they're all out now. They're campaigning, and they have all weighed in, but the emphasis is on the administration now. Thanks.
Thank you. Carlos?
Thanks. I just wanted to reiterate what I said last month, and kind of playing a bit of devil's advocate, just trying to see it from the Cal EPA side, that the tool they're using is to determine where the impact is in terms of, you know, whatever different environmental impacts there are on there. So it seems that it's showing that it's shifted to the Central Valley, and interestingly enough, too, the inner basin of Los Angeles, which you kind of make sense. It makes sense from, like, you know, winds and all this other stuff, you know, but really the thought, and that maybe the talking point to think about is with these decisions come a lot of money, and is that really where you want to start investing money and encouraging growth? If this is really about strategic growth, is that where you want to have the growth? So just that's kind of the question I would put out there.
Thank you. And I have a couple questions before we wrap this up. The 40% of the uncommitted funds, is there any indication as to whether I have $1 million to distribute, I'm going to hold back the $400,000, or is there any indication as to how that's going to work with the first rollout of money, or are they just going to start?
To date, there's not, and maybe Rebecca can add to this, but I think our expectation is probably that is going to be held over for the next state budget cycle, where they'll probably make a decision about who essentially gets to administer that money and what it's to be used for.
Okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, there was a lot of pressure to do a long-term structure this year, and it wasn't until the very last minute that a bill got passed that has these percentages. My, you know, sense is that the legislature will not want to lock up any more of that money, and they'd rather have the flexibility on an annual basis to just appropriate those funds. I'm sure there will be other interests trying to secure it and get it dedicated, but as of now, it's a jump ball, so we'll see next session.
My next question is, we've assumed a $3.1 billion influx, and I'm wondering if you have any comparison as to what everybody else has guesstimated and whether those numbers actually align with the state's numbers. And because my concern is based on their mapping process, is that going back to Carlos's statement, is if they go just on their map, I'm perceiving that means a lot more investment in areas with much lower populations.
Right. So just to clarify, there's a lot of numbers in here. The MTC framework assumes $3.1 billion to the region over 25 years. What we assume is that statewide, on an annual basis through cap and trade, we'll see $2.5 billion. And that's really, that is an assumption that we're making. You know, we think that it's, you know, reasonably conservative as assumptions go. There are some projections out there that are much higher than that. There are some that are lower, and we try to kind of take a middle ground approach. I think that, you know, we're all concerned in this region about that disadvantaged communities definition and the degree to which that might sort of funnel money away from the Bay Area. But also one thing to kind of clarify is that a lot of this is about disadvantaged communities, but it's not all about disadvantaged communities. And we should all remember that the requirement is that I think 25% of the cap and trade monies go to benefit disadvantaged communities. But there's also 75% of the funding as well. And so I think we're all, rightly so, getting caught up in the disadvantaged communities conversation. And it's important, but it's also important to recognize that it's not all the money. It's just a portion of the funds that need to be funneled there, but it doesn't all necessarily need to meet that specific criteria.
Thank you. And I have one more thing, which is kind of a pet peeve for me, and that's listing BART to San Jose rail cars. I never have seen a line item that said BART to Warm Springs cars. So this is an expansion of the BART line, and the reason that I'm bringing this up, I would rather see this expansion of BART system cars as opposed to naming San Jose, because I've had two politicians who should know better say, well, we're buying cars so San Jose can have BART. We're doing you a big favor. And I think simply by naming it BART to San Jose, we don't say, oh, we have to replace cars because we are expanding the Oakland extension or the San Francisco extension. It's a natural extension of the BART system. And we don't need to be, unless we're going to start naming how much each percentage of each extension is accruing costs, it just puts a flavor in there that doesn't. I would just ask that you just call it the expansion. Is that a hard thing to do? Or
are you just saying you would rather just see expansion cars for BART? Is that what you're...
Yes, because it's not... Because there is a presumption that the BART car... And this is by people who should know better, which means that if I'm trying to educate people who should know better, I'm having a really difficult time with the constituents, that BART won't be coming to San Jose except for the fact that we're getting extra money from outside. So they're looking at it as doing us a favor. And that to me is just, yeah, I'm sorry, but 30 years of taxes, I deserve a little bit better. Rich?
Yeah, I actually want to agree with you on that. I mean, it's pretty provincial to look at cars on a regional system as being for any one particular community. I travel to San Jose all the time. I'd love to go on BART instead of having to make two or three changes in transit. So I agree with you 100%. Maybe calling that does make people who are very provincial and look at life as nothing but fiefdoms saying, well, we're doing this for San Jose when you're doing it for the whole region.
Vita?
Since you mentioned the 25% of the funding being released to disadvantaged communities, I'm wondering how that process is working its way. I know that the Six Winds organization had visited the various commissioners to at least set a priority. Can you give us an update on that?
About the disadvantaged communities process through the state cap and trade program?
Yeah, the cap and trade funding coming from Sacramento.
Sure. So... I mentioned the 25% sort of overall, but each state program kind of has its own requirement for disadvantaged communities in terms of the amount of funding that's going to flow there. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I wish I could give you a great answer to this that clarifies everything, but we're still waiting, unfortunately. So we're really still waiting for clarity on that map and for them really to get to the final guidance in terms of how disadvantaged communities will be benefited through these different programs. You know, of course, the programs are pretty diverse. Some of them are about transit. Some of them are more about affordable housing. Mm-hmm. And there's different thought processes at play depending on what type of project you're talking about in terms of how you're articulating, well, what does benefit mean to disadvantaged communities? So I wish I could give you a better answer than that, but that's unfortunately that's where we are.
Can you give us an update for the next meeting, perhaps?
Sure.
Okay.
Happy to.
We'll have to check. We have a kind of a pact, but we'll put it on the list.
Okay. And then I had one other quick question, which referred back to slide number 12. And you mentioned that OBAG had a program to prioritize ag land use. Can you give us any examples of that?
So there is a program, one of the sort of the buckets of investment through OBAG is this priority conservation areas program. I'm actually personally unaware in terms of the status of that, so I'm going to look at Alex in terms of just kind of the status of where that is. Sorry, Alex.
Sure, no, that's fine. We approved $10 million, I believe, into the priority conservation area program. Five of it went to the North Bay, and then five of it was for the rest of the Bay Area, and we worked, I always forget, SCC, Rebecca helped me out, who we partnered with, Coastal.
Green Belt Alliance?
No, not Coastal Conservancy. Anyways, it might be the State Coastal Conservancy, I may have that wrong, but anyways, we partnered with them, they put in additional money, and we funded some projects, some of it was land easement projects, some were projects that were trail projects, Bay Trail projects. So we can get you a list of the projects. We approved it back in April.
That would be great. Maybe you could funnel that through Pam?
Sure.
Okay.
Thank you. We need to get rolling on our next topic, but thank you for the update. And it's as frustrating for you as it is for us. So
It's okay. It's my job.
Yeah.
just trying to make it simple for everybody else out there.
Thank you very much. And we'll be moving into our next agenda item, which is the legislative advocacy program. And how that will work is we will get a short briefing from staff. We will break out into groups. This is my favorite project when we do these things, because I think we get to actually talk to each other a little bit more and then come back from our focus groups. So, Pam, I will let you take it away.
Actually,
oh, no, it's Rebecca. Sorry.
Okay. Hi, everybody. So I think we've tried to combine a couple of ideas here, which is sort of building on the discussion related to funding options from the last meeting, and also talking about our legislative program for the 2015 session. This is sort of the time of year when, you know, I start talking to my counterparts in other agencies and across the state about ideas for next session, and it's always nice to get some input from you all before we come back with a draft, right, so that you can actually feed us ideas that we can incorporate into the draft. So we will be coming back in November with our draft 2015 program. There were a couple of items that I highlighted in the memo as far as revenue ideas that seemed to be of interest. One was looking at the road user fee, or the VMT charge, and the other one was an oil extraction tax, which I believe Alan had raised as an idea that is long overdue in California. So those were a couple of ideas that maybe we want to talk about in the smaller group, and that's pretty much the idea.
And how will we be breaking out into those groups?
So, yeah, I added my name to this item just to help facilitate us break out. We have three semicircles set up here in the room for us to break out. If we do groups of at least five, and I think you're probably good with self-selecting. Hopefully you can self-select yourselves into groups of five to six per group. And we have some staff people to help facilitate a discussion in those group sessions. Again, we're just going to be talking about legislative ideas to help Rebecca. Rebecca will be leading one of those discussions, and we've also got Christina and Leslie to help. I'll be walking around and just kind of timekeeping to make sure we're on track to talk for about 20 to 30 minutes or so, and to just keep the ideas flowing in your group sessions, and there'll be note-taking for you. And choose someone in your group to report back to the larger group when we come back, reconvene back in the larger group, anything that you came up with in your small group.
I just thought I would add a little bit onto that. Before I came downstairs, I grabbed our 2014 LEDGE program. Probably would have been a good idea to bring copies of that, but I'll just kind of quickly summarize some of the things that we've had in the past. Some of them we've actually accomplished, quite a few, so that's kind of a nice feeling. Doesn't always happen. So, you know, we've been talking for many years about lowering the vote threshold for local taxes from two-thirds to a simple majority. You know, that's something, sort of a long-standing item. It's very difficult to do, so I'm not even sure if we should bother to put it in there. but it's kind of almost like a, you know, one of the Ten Commandments that we keep trying. Let's see. Cap and trade is something that, you know, I think there's a worthwhile conversation to be had. Should we be looking at ways to maybe address that? Some of the concerns about disadvantaged communities, but as far as trying to secure the funds, we've kind of done that in some fashion already. Tax increment financing with the elimination of redevelopment, that's been a big concern, and just finding a funding source for affordable housing. So if you have ideas about that, there was a bill passed this session, SB 628. It was signed at the very last minute by the governor. It's a Senator Bell bill. And it basically allows local jurisdictions to use tax increment financing, again, for all kinds of infrastructure projects, including affordable housing, but also, you know, any kind of transportation project. In fact, there's a language that says any project that implements an SCS, a sustainable community strategy, is eligible. The big deal is that there's no more voter approval requirement to form an infrastructure financing district, so you can do it through just an action of your city council or whatever jurisdictions are agreeing to pool the revenue. To issue bonds, you still need to get a vote of the people. But that's something we've talked about. And I think if you just have ideas about other affordable housing revenue sources or local revenue sources, we're very open to that.
Just a question about the tax increment financing. I'm aware of how you get there with for-profit organizations where you use increment financing to bring them into the community. If they develop jobs or other positive things for the community. But how do we do it with government and nonprofit things like below market rate housing?
Well, so the way that I'm talking about tax increment financing, this is sort of similar to redevelopment where a city, let's just take a city and a let's just take a city, keep it simple. A city decides, okay, this particular area, this six-block area, is where we think there's going to be a lot more property value growth, and there is, let's say, a transit station near there. We're going to divert the growth in this area just to that particular area, so that rather than having that tax revenue be spread throughout the city and used throughout the city, it's focused in that area.
Like we're doing in the city at the transit center and all the debates.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes, so it's not related to the. Yeah, yeah.
Let me just caution you. So for a brainstorm to work, you don't necessarily need to propose something that is perfect.
Right.
You have to just kind of think outside the box, just even if you don't know how it's going to work, or even if it's something that's not necessarily going to work next year or the year after or 5 years from now. Yeah. If it's something that you think, hey, what about this? Mm-hmm. Just go ahead and bring it up.
Yeah.
And everything is possible. And just put it, no limits, just put it out there, and we put it on the board, knowing that it might not make it into the LEDGE program this time. So
right.
You just need to know that. But that's what a true brainstorm is all about. So that's what we're doing today. And also, when you self-select, maybe go gravitate towards a group of people that you don't know yet. That might be something to try.
Okay, everybody self-select, find a group, and we'll see you back here in about 20-some-odd minutes.
Our group came up with a few stellar ideas to ask the legislature. The first one is a VMT gas tax. So we want them to discuss what kind of limit replacement consideration, and if Sacramento plans, I'm not really sure what this means, plans with loss of gas tax. So we considered a few pros and cons for this, and the one of the issues that we were concerned about is VMT and low-income drivers possibly still, is this a viable option for them? And the next one is to increase toll roads even beyond those that we've planned already. So looking around regionally for those that are planned and more. So model the toll roads from other states. And then thirdly, we're looking at a return to a truck weight fee to HTF. So
thank you. And you just hit it on the 2-minute mark. That's awesome. Woo-hoo! Let's hear it for team one. Team two, I'm seeing Naomi up and about.
Oh, that's working. Okay. I'd like to say, first of all, that this first page is not all my fault, even though it looks like it would be. So the first one is sustainable funding for mobility management, which is related to transportation for seniors and people with disabilities. Next, we had several ideas around better management of disabled parking placards by the DMV, such as tracking doctor's approvals and increasing the fines for illegal parking in disabled zones to the maximum possible. Okay, go ahead. We had some concerns about clarifying the use of electric bicycles and their definition and where they can ride, requiring bike paths to be painted green, addressing some gaps in service, such as first and last mile connectivity, funding for those types of programs, late night service. And then we had some zoning things about increasing incentives for businesses to move into certain areas, which are sort of enterprise zones where they're not currently locating. And maybe to tie that to SCS-defined processes like PDAs, or we had a term PDA+. We had a little random thing, which may not be very correct in this crowd, but if high-speed rail does not happen, redirect those funds to local transit. Make transit agencies more responsible for the bike theft that happens on their facilities or on their buses, right off of their buses, as it were. And this is also the zoning incentivized creation of all types of housing to be created, such as low-income housing, even in high-job areas. And we approve of the temporary license plate program. And maybe some sort of VMT pilot for electrical vehicles, or in place of that, pose a tax on battery replacements or at the charging stations, or related to that, allow electric resale for electric cars, and also dedicated right-of-way for passenger rail versus freight. So we're kind of all over the place. Thank you.
Thank you, Team 2, an eclectic combination of things. Woo-hoo! Team 3 will send to Alan.
Well, you might think because I like the extraction tax as much as I did, that that would be on our list, and I don't want to disappoint you. It is. The extraction tax does a lot of good things, and we think that you can get something like this passed if it's put together well. The thing I do know is an extraction tax will come. And unless we are at the table, unless the MTC is at the table, the extraction tax will go in other directions. The money's going to be there. It'll go to the general fund. It'll go to all the schools. It'll go somewhere else. And none of it will go to transportation unless we participate in making it happen. We are probably going to be one of the highest fuel-generating states in the country. Let's take advantage of it. I right now am doing a study, and hopefully I'll have a white paper by our next meeting to distribute on that subject. Next subject, workforce housing. This is off the subject of income, but workforce housing is important for our communities. People can't afford to live in our communities. The College of San Mateo, and we should study their model, has workforce housing for their professors and their workers. It's paying for itself, and it can pay for itself with an investment from the MTC, from a tax area, from something, and we can have our emergency service workers here when we need them. Last subject. We think there needs to be some bicycle education. We're creating bike lanes. We're creating smart streets. We want that as alternate transportation, but a lot of cyclists have bad manners. Some have good manners. Some of them are arrogant. But we have to set a rule of law with biking like we do driving a car. And we have to make people responsible for what they're doing with their bicycles. And we have to teach drivers, auto drivers, how to deal with bicycles.
Thank you, Team 3. Yay! So I'm assuming that staff will put all of these ideas down in one chart for us to look at.
Yes, we will be doing that. As we've done in the past with your brainstorming ideas, we'll be putting these all together in a list for you. And we'll also be giving them all to Rebecca, and she'll be looking those over. And we'll be coming back to you with the draft ledge program at your next meeting.
Thank you. That takes us on to item number 8, our staff liaison report. Pam?
Well, I'm going to go backwards on this. I'm sure, as usual, that you've all read it, but just to point out a few highlights, one of the things I wanted to mention in the executive director's report, which I'm sure you all read in its entirety, to note John Ferran, who is considered the founding father of MTC, passed away recently, and I just wanted to note that for you. There is a nice write-up on MTC's website on him if you are unaware of who he was and what he did for the creation of this agency. So I encourage you to take a look at that and read a little bit about him. Also, there's a last few chances for you to get to drive an electric vehicle at the Experience Electric The Better Ride events that are occurring around the region. This year, we think there will probably be some more events that will be occurring in the future, but the last chances for this year are happening in October, so I've highlighted those for you to get a chance in Walnut Creek, Fairfax, and San Jose coming up. Couple of reports I highlighted for you, and also the upcoming potential Waiting with Bated Breath TIP adoption. It was adopted by the commission. It now goes forward to the state. So that's on there. And then also our award ceremony that happens every 2 years that my staff is currently scurrying around getting ready for. It's coming up in 2 weeks, October 22nd in the morning. And you should have all gotten an email invite to that. And so please see me if you didn't get that. You should have gotten that. It starts at 8:30 at the Scottish Rite here in Oakland. And our own Naomi Armenta is going to be honored with an award at that event. So we're very proud of her.
I will say I sat on the selection committee for that. And it was an incredible thing to sit on. There were a huge number of applications. There's something in it for everybody, and I strongly encourage everybody to go attend and make sure that your representatives are there. And congratulations, Naomi. Yours was not argued about, by the way. That was like, yeah, we're not arguing about this one at all. Well-deserved, by the way. And now we're on to council member reports. Does anybody have any reports on locally relevant issues or events? Yes.
Hi, Elizabeth Clary from Sonoma County. Just two things. We had a very successful Safe Routes to School event in Sonoma County this morning. Walk, bike, and roll, or something like that. Walk, roll, walk and roll. Anyway. It was fabulous. In Petaluma, as I drove into, I had to drive in. It's kind of a long story, but we parked four blocks away. It was just so cool to see everybody doing their thing to get to school. So super fun and successful, and the kids were really fired up. Also, just a reminder that October celebrates employment of people with disabilities. So there's a lot of wonderful local events going on. On the 15th, both Napa, I know, and Sonoma County have their mayor's breakfast, which have really, you know, inspiring and exciting stories to share. So just wanted to share. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Alan.
Well, this is something personal to me. We are taking our project, which is 599 apartment units, to our planning commission for the final, not the final EIR, that's been finished a long time, the final design approvals this month. And our meeting is coming up Tuesday night in San Mateo. And it's what we hope is the design of a perfect transit village. It's within... I guess a 16th of a mile of the Caltrain station, Hayward Park Station, in San Mateo. It's a multimodal project that also has bus transportation, and it is right next to Highway 92. And it would be interesting, you know, any of you are invited to take a look at it or come to the meeting, or I'll bring the stuff here sometime, but it's... It's also LEED Gold ND, and it's the first LEED Gold, and one of the first LEED Gold ND projects approved, and it's very environmentally stable. We don't have it on our website. It's on San Mateo's website as the meeting, but we don't have it on a website. Thank you.
Thank you. Any more announcements? New business? To bring up at future meetings, going once, twice, three times. With that, I do believe we're finished for the day and adjourned.
Yes, I'm tired.
Thank you, folks. We'll see you next month.